In the Philippines, a small helicopter headed for a clearing on the eastern flank of Mount Sikapu, covered by lush subtropical jungle. It landed on a small, devastated clearing where trees had been clipped and felled by the crashing airliner. Its wreckage lay scattered over scorched earth midst a ragged ring of dense forest. Half a dozen officials and sanctioned reporters, all men in safety vests, gathered around torn pieces of the fuselage. Fran ducked from the chopper, its thundering wind tearing at her hair and khaki work clothing and vest. Two men, local officials, vested in dark olive uniforms, followed her. The helicopter lifted off immediately. The men waved for Fran to come with them to the center of the crash zone. She shook her head and indicated with a wide arc of her hand that she was going to look around the edges. As she headed out, the departing helicopter's roar faded into the gentler sounds of wind and birds. One of the men shouted to her in Tagalog-accented English, "The story is over here, and look!" He pulled a rapidly growing vine from a scrap of debris. "The jungle grows fast. Just 2 days, we have this. In 2 weeks, you won't find anything. The edges are hopeless already." Fran ignored him and walked through the tangled, blitzed greenery toward the intact rainforest. She flipped open a spiral-bound notebook and drew a rough sketch of the site and added an X to mark where she started her search. She fought her way through overgrowth and undergrowth, looking for scattered pieces of airplane and personal belongings among foliage and stems. She picked up a woman's dress shoe, tiny and immaculate, then put it back and noted its location. She found a wallet-sized flip booklet of family photographs that included an old black-and-white portrait of a young Asian couple who, in recent photos, had become the wrinkled patriarch and matriarch presiding over a grandchild's wedding. Tears were inevitable. She didn't fight them. She carefully returned the family to its leafy perch and marked their resting place on her sketch. This might be her story if nothing better showed up, although that would be typical news, however heartrending. In any case, she'd alert her escorts to what she found so they could document and remove it. Flies covered a small object. She waved her foot over it, and the insect swarmed up to reveal a decomposing hand with liquefying thumb and fingers. She started to retch, but held it down. She drew a tiny stick hand on her drawing and hurried on. When she was nearly finished her loop, sweating and drained, the hair rose on her arms and neck. She stopped and looked around. She listened. Nothing. The men in the distance continued quietly collecting debris near the wreckage. She took another step, then stopped again, weirdly spooked. She shouted to one of the men, "Hey, Sammy, what eats people out here?" He shouted back, "Only cannibals, don't worry." "What about snakes?" "Talk nice to them," he said. He and his partner laughed. The other man muttered, "Stupid Yankees, do what they please, think later." She backed away a few steps, her skin goose-pumping. Where was it? There, that bush, that bramble of dark leaves. Gingerly, she returned to it and pulled it aside. A set of eyes bore into her. 6-year-old eyes, an Asian Caucasian girl huddled in an airplane blanket, staring inscrutably at her. Oh, my God," Fran gasped. "Oh, you poor baby." She crouched to look at the girl, reaching cautiously out to her. The girl sat uncannily still, as beautiful as a doll. She continued staring without a blink. "Do you live here? How did you get here? Of course you don't speak English." "Yes, I do," the girl said with an American accent. Fran's eyes widened as she whispered, "You're from the plane, unhurt." The girl barely nodded. "You've been here 2 whole days?" Another nod. "You never cried? You never called for anyone?" "They're all dead." "But you can hear people over there, rescuers." "My family is all dead." "Oh, dear God. Oh, sweetheart, we have to look after you. We have to get you water and food and..." She pulled an edge of the blanket away from the girl. "You're okay? I mean, are you hurt? Is that why you didn't move?" The girl shook her head. Fran removed the blanket to reveal the girl entirely intact, her pretty dress scarcely dirty or awry and no mark on her. She asked, "May I carry you out?" The girl nodded. Fran picked her up gently and gave her a tender kiss on the temple as the girl snuggled into her arms. Crying, Fran said, "Oh, sweet baby, sweet precious girl, you are so brave, you are so wonderful." Fran walked toward the closer of the two officials. He looked up at her in disbelief, then whistled loudly between his teeth and waved to the other one. He looked over with equal astonishment. They rushed to join Fran and the girl, one fellow shouting at the other, "Radio the helicopter, we have a survivor." When the police arrived at the front door of the party house, Deanne slipped out the back door into a rainy black night. She skirted the covered pool, climbed the back fence, and cut through a few neighbors' yards on the shortest route home. Dogs barked from decks apparently contained or tethered because none came after her. She disappeared past them like a shadow. At her dad and Cindy's house, motion sensor lights caught her in the glare. The security camera showed a bedraggled ghoul, eyes glittery black with dilated pupils. She hit the doorbell and waited. She rang it again and sloppily pounded on the door. While she thumped, her dad flipped on the entryway lights and opened the door to his lost puppy girl. "Oh, thank God," Ralph exclaimed, then turned to yell, "Cindy, love, it's the Anne." To the Anne, he said, "Where in heck have you been? Look at you, you're a mess." She pushed past him into the house. "Nice to see you, too." He closed the door and looked into her eyes. "Are you all right? Are you..." "Oh, no. You're stoned. On what, Deanne?" "Lawn clippings." Deanne giggled uncontrollably at her joke. "Grass, my ass." Ralph shook her shoulders to sober her. "Who did this to you?" Cindy appeared, her braless breasts heaving under a filmy negligee. "Sweet Jesus, my prayers have been answered." Looking skyward, she said, "Thank you, God, thank you." Ralph persisted. "Come on, fess up. Who's been corrupting my firstborn?" Deanne walked toward her bedroom, flaunting her tiny skirt and sweater. Cindy bought them, you figure." Through the open doorway, she saw that her room had been restored to childish order. "Oh, Christ," she moaned as she went in and kicked the door shut. Ralph shouted at her, "We'll talk in the morning, little miss." Cindy said, "Call the police, Ralph, so they know she's home." She rolled her eyes upward again. "Oh, the power of prayer. That's what got her back. The Lord's sweet mercy and the power of my prayers. Hallelujah." Ralph put his arm around her shoulder. "Yeah, and pass the whiskey, sweetheart. I'm a wreck." Fran insisted that the girl from the plane crash be taken to the nearest village hospital to spare her the trauma of a longer flight into chaotic Manila. Her emotional condition, shell shock for sure, had to be addressed before adding to it. On signing in, the girl whispered that her name was Angela Cho. Fran smiled. An angel, of course, a miracle from heaven. And Cho, she knew, like Cho Cho San in Madame Butterfly, meaning butterfly, another sort of miracle on wings. Within a large thatched roof building, the girl sat propped in a cot, a picture of perfect health. She shared the single open room with a dozen other female patients, young and old, lying low and quiet from various maladies and mishaps. Fran sat on the edge of the bed, holding one of the girl's hands. She kept her other one tightly clenched. Fran reached to cover the little fist with her big hand and said softly, "It's okay now. Well, as okay as it can be. You're warm and safe, and everything's going to settle down. Come on, let's hold both hands." Angela snatched her fist away and put it under the covers. She held her dark eyes fast on Fran's face as Fran wrapped her two hands around the girl's free one and said, "Well, you know what's best. That's how you survived. That and a million horseshoes. Do you know what happens next?" The girl nodded. "After you're back in the States and you have a new home at your aunt and uncle's house, could I phone you if you'd like that? See how you're doing?" The girl nodded again. "I'll do that. Now I have to leave, okay? I'm going to see my own girl, the one I told you about, who just turned 13. Your aunt's with you now, and there are lots of other good people here to look after you. In a couple of days, you'll be together with your cousins in Portland. Yay!" Fran kissed her on the forehead, whispering, "Goodbye, sweet Angela," then softly left the room. She hurried past the small, clean nursing station and several nurse nuns in white wimples over dark smocks. At the exit door, she slipped past the local doctor making his rounds, her head down to hide her glistening eyes about to overflow. While broadcasting her final report on the crash, Fran fought to hold down a sea of untapped tears. Her throat ached and words scattered. She had nothing to say about any of it, except that it was over. 143 lives had vanished. Angela's former life was finished, and Fran was, too, in ways. She couldn't begin to articulate what had shifted in the depth of her being, let alone what it might mean. The news was about going from here, heading through shock and grief for Angela, as if the little girl's upset life were her own, facing new territory with only hope and a tender heart for guides. She signed off by requesting that the news-hungry world give Angela the privacy and space she needed to find her feet and live out her sweetest dreams. Fran spent the night on the balcony of her hotel room in Manila, the same place as before with lover boy, but that had been long days and a lifetime before. She lay back on a deck chair, tears gushing beyond her control. Neon lights flashed garish colors over her face. Traffic whooshed, roared, and occasionally wailed in her ears. She smoked steadily, stubbing the butts in a potted palm beside her. She asked herself repeatedly, what had come over her from the moment she found Angela? Why such pain and sense of loss now that Angela was safe and heading for a whole new life? Fran knew well the feeling of being done with an interview or a story she'd been chasing. That instinct made her one of the best in the business, because she could cut to the quick, then cut and run, as politely as required. This time something huge in her had slammed shut in her when. Exactly when, sitting with Angela in the hospital, holding her hands, her determined little fist. With astonishing certainty, Fran knew that she was finished with her entire reporting career and, this is what disturbed her beyond words, life as she knew it. No more longing for more time with Deanne, without missing a beat at work. No more promises to fix things up on the home front, somehow, someday. The impossibility of what she'd been trying to do for years, to broadcast what's happening in this crazy world, as if that might nudge it toward increased awareness and understanding, if not enlightenment and justice, came instantly clear. She was the same old Fran, same old instincts and bad habits, but she was different, too, changed from the inside out, irrevocably. Touched by a miracle, gack, she hated clichés as much as she dismissed touchy-feely New Age cant. Yet here she was, dog-paddling through a storm of tears, suffering a long black night of the soul. Grief overwhelmed her, but for what? Not the plane crash victims, not Angela's fate, not all the years of all the tragedy she'd covered, not the pattern of her own life, none of her own losses, certainly not the choices she'd made and the prices she'd paid for them. It was the end, that was all. Time to hang up and walk away. Then what? Aside from being mum in town for the Anne, reasons for this change and plans for carrying on escaped her. It hurt ridiculously while feeling good like a tough scrub. Tabula rasa, the slate wiped wonderfully, frighteningly clean. Or was this a burnout, a breakdown? She'd known only too well her parents' inabilities to cope. But this wasn't anything like the turns their particular demons took them through. She felt too solid about this catharsis, too sure that something positive lay at the heart of it. The problem was, what next to fill her sudden surfeit of days? How to begin, and then what? She was going to quit. No, she had quit. It was over. The only work she'd known, was really passionate about, and did exceptionally well. How would she break it to Larry? Make a living? Even if she could afford to play full-time Susie homemaker to the end, it would be too little, too late. She could, what, slice tomatoes in the neighborhood deli? That had a certain appeal. Nothing else came to mind. Running on empty. Tabula rasa. Light another cigarette. By dawn, the palm's soil was heaped with butts, and Fran's temples ached, as if a bolt had been driven through them. She scooped the cigarette dregs into a garbage basket, then gulped back a liter of bottled water, along with 3 Tylenol 3s. After standing full face in a cool shower until she started to shiver, she packed her bags in record time. In the back seat of a taxi, deeking through traffic, Fran dialed a long string of numbers into her cell phone and waited. Nothing. She dialed again. Squeals this time, then. I'm sorry, we're unable to complete your call. On her third try, she seethed at the phone. Come on, don't do this to me. The driver jumped. Do what? He glanced back and chortled. That thing drive you crazy, huh? Eyes front again, he added. I just drive you zigzag. Fran laughed, then cringed from a stab of headache pain. Finally, she connected. Ralph, thank goodness. I'm on the moon here, fighting to get back. I'm taking the next flight home. Stand by, whatever I can get. Tell the Anne, okay? She listened, her eyes widening, jaw dropping. She what? For 2 days? Oh, God. Fran dropped her voice. Just weed? She said lawn clippings? Oh, that's very funny. Why the hell didn't you call me? Her temple veins bulged in sobs. Oh, sure, sure, she's fine. Forget Mom. You didn't even think to call me, did you? I can't believe it. I'm on my way home, you hear? And I'm staying home. Tell her she's going to have me in town for as long as it takes. What do you mean, what about my high-flying job? I'm quitting. I'm done forever. You just watch. I'll be home sometime tomorrow, and I'm heading straight for the Anne. You tell her that, please. Bye. As the cabbie unloaded Fran's bags at the airport, he said, Everything okay, miss? It's going to be, she said, fishing for every non-U.S. coin she could find in her purse to make a large handful for a tip. His eyes widened. Thanks for the zigzag, she said. Now I'm gone for good. As good as I can make it. Paalam na po. Paalam Manila. Randy Tellman had again invaded Larry's domain without warning or knocking. He ushered in a young man and woman pushing a dolly stacked with two cardboard boxes. The woman had three pierced navel rings showing between top and low-rise jeans and more than a dozen rings in her eyebrows and ears. Her platinum brush cut sprouted a few long blue tendrils that curled down her snake-tattooed neck. The man smelled of cigarette smoke in his paint-spattered sweatshirt and jeans, oversized runners, tiny sunglasses, and purple-tufted hair. A small silver coin sat in the middle of his chin, an eye-catching rivet. Larry jumped to his feet, as much from annoyed surprise as to get them out as quickly as he could. Randy said, Permit me to introduce my graduate students. Well, graduating this year with some help from me. He wrapped the top box. And your blessings. The young woman extended her hand to Larry. Hey, she said. He shook without a word. Okay, the young man said, flopping in the chair where Maya had sat. He looked around the office and nodded. Yep, been here, seen that. He grinned at Larry. What in hell is going on? Larry quietly asked Randy. Hey, no budget, low budget, don't stop this boy. I've been getting real about the way I want things done around here. I'm bringing you the plan, the execution, team reps, and ta-da, one sweet final product. Randy opened the folded flaps of the top box and took out a flash drive labeled Rewind, One Life. He handed it to Larry. What is it? Half-hour show? 22 minutes, the woman said. Randy continued, an experiment, a prototype, the wave of the future, and we're on it. I hit the university and recruited a film prof and his little elves, the woman snickered, who took my idea and ran with it. Half a dozen did the assignment, own scouting, own angles, all lone wolf in the field, all handheld except for stock footage, a day checking to edit, add sound, and voila, it's done. Low cost, no cost to us, university paid, and look, instant profile. The kids get credit, and I get what I want. Young, with-it reporters who don't need a crew. We're bringing you the equipment, hard drives, everything that went into it, rough footage, class and field notes, some hot new journalism techs, and lots of downloads thrown in. Why not? What's it about? Larry asked, eyes narrowed suspiciously. You. Your life. It's brilliant. You made a show about my life, Larry said, eyes wide now. Listen, we can whip these babies off 2-3 a week. And beat biography and who do you think you are all to hell. We'll scoop their audience and get the millennials and Gen Alphas too. It's so immediate, you know. I did like you said. You're the original spark. I took my videoing from here. Remember my tour through here with the big handheld last week? And showed, Randy pointed upward with his thumb to indicate the penthouse boss. He got talking about you, how you broke ground in this business and how I got to learn from you. Take it further. Which gave me this great, I mean great, idea. It's perfect, an honor, a service I'm doing you, man. I mean, I show you what I mean by showing you, right? The news behind the news. Who decides what goes into the news theater? You like that term, news theater, right? It's brilliant, of the whole world, with you as the first act. Larry said, no, I hate it. That's not news at all, not, Randy spun around. We covered you from day one as a director here, then back through senior reporter, cub reporter, high school, prom date, grade one. We even got a scoop on your dad, your real dad, and did your adoption. Larry blinked. You got what? My God, did it ever occur to you that this is immoral and unscrupulous and doubtless illegal and indictable? All public information, public records. People talk freely, nothing we needed permission for. No deep, dark searches, the young woman said. Nothing current either, like where you live, how you live. That would be too, you know, Larry demanded. Too invasive, you think? Too none of your goddamn business? Randy said, hey, lighten up. It's a practice run and a great idea. It's not public or anything yet, and it's a nice little gift for you, a keepsake. You know, for your family, for your kids, or no kids. That's all cool. The young woman said, yeah, it's like a major compliment. We think you're awesome and have done great things. We're trying to build something from it, go beyond, know what I mean? The young man added, I love your old dude, Dad. Still crazy about your mom, his virgin bride. He savored the last two words. He's way cool. Larry shouted, that old dude's a jerk and a bum. He disappeared when I was a baby, for God's sake. Abel Singer's my dad, my only dad, you arrogant, prying schmucks. Randy stepped back and crossed his index fingers in mock fear, saying, whoa, dude, you got issues, big time. I mean, if you can't accept your past and the way things are and how the future's coming on, well, I'm sorry, but who's seen this, Larry growled, other than the class? You mean upstairs? No, Big L hasn't seen anything yet. Hi, you ain't seen nothing yet. Who's lying? Randy looked at his companions, who shrugged. Hell, Jolson, you Jeopardy losers. First words in the first big talkie. Larry, you're going to love it, I know, and we're going to take this technique and fly with it. This is the hottest thing since, he turned to his acolytes. Hey, since what? You, man, she said. It's been so, like, big time, the young man said. It's halfway from music videos, you know, because that's how we expect things to move when they're at the switch. Ch-ch-ch-ch-ch, he mimed operating remote control, his head bobbing like a boxer's. Larry asked, how many people have the files, the final cut? This is it. I mean, there's all the footage and stuff. That's in thumb drives and cloud stuff. But we got everyone involved to sign a waiver that there'd be no leaks or they could kiss goodbye a job anywhere in this business. I mean, anywhere. So these boxes are the whole story, like Aladdin's lamp, waiting for the magic to get out and change the news-telling world. Get out, Larry said. Leave all this. And oh, God, he sighed. Goodbye, like right now. Randy said, hey, man, we got scruples, you know. You got to trust us. Let us hang here while you watch it, and guaranteed you're going to love it. Then we show it upstairs, and guaranteed Uncle Al loves it, and that's it. The concept flies. Everything's in here, trust me, every bit and piece. That's why it takes a couple of boxes for the whole freaking assignment, not just on a little file on a drive. Larry steamed, oh no, oh no, oh, I can't believe that you've... Randy cut in, no, I can't believe you're taking it like this. You haven't seen it. You don't even know what you're up against. Why are you so resistant? Change is coming, with or without you. So here's the best damn thing that's happening now, anywhere. I mean, you're looking at the future right here. And this whole piece is all about you, and you're fighting it like crazy Canute trying to stop the tide, and it's not fair. You just can't... Larry held up his hand. You stop right there. Crazy Canute was showing his assembled idiots that you can't stop the tide. But you're not interested in getting the story right, are you? You're just into the bullshit and razzle-dazzle and playing games, while people out there are living hard lives and dying hard, or dying so hard you can't imagine it. And you're trying to tell me that anything in these boxes matters? That telling the news about who the hell tells the news is somehow news? Give me a break, and I mean, are you listening? Give me a break, as in leave, like right now. Randy squared himself up, his young companion's shoulders slumped. Larry said, I'm sorry for you kids, I'm really sorry. You've been part of something I consider unscrupulous and unprofessional, and you better start learning that right now if you want careers in the business. I won't hold it against you. I won't look at the class list. I won't remember you, okay? You're off scot-free. Now, class dismissed. Finished. Out. Whoa, surprise ending, the young man mumbled, heading for the door. Sorry. Randy followed them out Larry's door, saying, yeah, sorry for you, old man. By the time you get it, it'll be way too late. To his companions, heading past Nora's workstation, he said, come on, I'll give you A pluses and your favorite whatever for taking this shit. As Larry reached to close the door, Nora said hesitantly, Mr. Singer, I'm really sorry to bother you, but this just arrived, and it's marked urgent. She picked up a large padded envelope and held it out for Larry. The waybill was addressed in black felt pen, his name underlined in red. No need to look at the return address to know who'd couriered to him. Larry took the envelope and returned to his riled cocoon, his former sanctuary. Randy was beyond belief. Did that really happen? A dolly bearing two new boxes said yes. Boxes of books, notes, equipment, God knew how many digital copies on the ethers. How was Larry going to tell Uncle Al about this final straw without telling him what this wart on his butt did? Then Al would want to see the file and be damned, that was unthinkable. Larry dropped into his chair behind the rubble heap that once was his desk and opened the envelope from May. He pulled out a video cassette marked Jerry McMahon. He knew the story. A recent little item about a fisherman surviving a freak storm. A file folder accompanied the video labeled Coincidentals. A small post-it note stuck on it said, "Call me soon, dear, or just drop by. Best love." He smiled as he stuck the note on his phone, a sweet request in the midst of turmoil. The file contained a dozen or so photocopied pages of newspaper articles May had clipped, noting their source and date. Larry quickly skimmed through them. All were about people surviving disasters in some way or other. Lucky them, he thought. They beat the Reaper, but he wasn't calm enough to read their stories now. He put the material back and rubbed his pained head, longing for sleep. He couldn't remember ever having felt so spent. With all the energy he could muster, he plugged in the flash drive marked Final, rewind, and fell into the nearest chair to watch. It opened in Larry's office, all as loopy and gut-churning as expected, with chaotic music. That mess quickly cut to Uncle Al's huge office, bouncing in the same handheld quake. The big, chubby guy was striding on his elliptical trainer by the bank of windows overlooking the Baltimore Inner Harbor, working out in his work pants and shirt, the sleeves rolled up. He talked about Larry being a role model for up-and-coming talent like young Randall Tellman III, who should study his life to see how he did it. Randy's voiceover then said, "That's just what I did, iterated too many annoying times." The footage backtracked through time via clips of Larry as director, producer, senior correspondent, pack reporter, and young stringer. They were blessedly steady camera shots set to a frenetic, blasting hip-hop beat. Time reeled back further to photos of him in school yearbooks, taken with zooming handheld shots and stuttered samples of old top-hit songs. Time and sound froze for long seconds on a grainy photo of Larry and his prom date, the dark-haired dazzler, Lindy Ann. Fast forward 35 years, and there she was, so blonde he didn't recognize her, as tarted up as a has-been starlet, with numerous facelifts of questionable success. She talked about how incredibly smart Larry was, and even though he was different from the other guys, she respected that. Wanted to help him and hoped she had. "Call me when you see this, hey Lair," she said with a final wave using her baby finger, her little cue for when a handsome teacher they both liked walked by. He closed his eyes and groaned, "Oh, God." His younger sister and brother had their say next, and just their say, all done as voiceovers, talking about the last time they saw Larry at a family gathering in Iowa last summer. The accompanying images were flashes and whirls of wheat fields interspersed with home video shots of the family barbecue, mostly little kids being rambunctious and bratty. Big half-brother, no, three-quarters, technically, his brother said. Great guy, quiet, hard-working, got me through school. His sister chuckled. Remember the time he set up War of the Worlds, that old Orson Welles radio play, and got us totally convinced it was real? Scared the hell out of us, sheesh. We've never been the same since. Great guy, though. Totally focused. Totally into something, or, well, totally gone onto something else. Always news-related, though. Always. Larry fast-forwarded through his receding past, from high school to kindergarten in a blur. He whizzed by his parents' graves and stopped on a wedding photo of his mom and dad, Bea and Abel Singer. Abel had died in a construction accident just months after Larry and Lindy had waltzed off to the prom. In the movie Dad had made of their departure in a limo with a bunch of their friends, he said the perfect couple, capturing forever his wishes. Perfectly odd if he'd known the truth, but he didn't, and it didn't matter now. The old guy was 54 then, 2 years older than Larry now. May's talk of Singers being long-lived couldn't be measured by his dad, who was really his uncle. His grandfather Samuel lived for 90-plus years, but his last decades were a long, turmoiled backtrack into complete senility. Larry never knew him when there was much to know. The story rushed on to the final star of the show, his birth father, Abel's older brother Solomon. That was Larry's main interest in this whole story exercise, and for one reason only, medical. The old bastard would be pushing 80 now, and Larry needed to see what his own physical mental fate might be if he could outwit this damned lump on his leg. Saul Singer was a wreck, a bald geezer who chased trouble until it got the best of him. He was coherent, however, and canny enough to call himself a freelance bottle collector operating out of a New York dive for indigence. Experienced bottle emptier too, no doubt. His grim fingers held a worn old photo of himself as a handsome groom with his beautiful Gentile bride, Beatrice Winters, my virgin bride, she relished the words, mother of my boy, my only kid. And let me tell you, she did a great job raising him after I had a little hard work out of town. Larry groaned. Oh, you scum, hard time in the slammer, you filthy lying bigamist. Two wives, one kid here, a couple of stepkids there, no damn conscience. The tape ended with Saul and his buddy sitting in a smoky, filthy communal TV room watching Media 8 News. A recent report played in the background as Saul said, "That's my boy, my boy's boss of that show." A toothless crony muttered, "You say that every damn time." "Larry," Saul said. "His name is Larry." Despite crappy camera work, obnoxious soundtrack, and lousy editing, Larry knew that the story and his old man were dynamite, that Randy had nailed something. After several minutes of sitting stunned, feeling his pulse thumping from chest to tumid brain, Larry let the tears roll. It was all so stupidly sad, with nothing in it for him, not personally, and definitely not as a way to tell any kind of news or news about news tellers. Why not destroy that shitty little USB right now? Not because there weren't backups of it forever, just because it would feel so goddamn good. Come on, do it. Grind it under your heel. Smash it to smithereens with a sledgehammer. Kill it like it was Randy himself, that presumptuous, overbearing, unbelievable son of a Larry couldn't, though. Because it was also pointless in the cyber world of storage, spies, and leakers everywhere. Moreover, even if he could make every copy of every file in this brilliant fucking rewind disappear, that was still his life in there, big chunks sliced up like chopped liver and delivered on a platter. He'd just tuck this misery into his latest telling news notebook, and he'd shred and recycle everything in the boxes, of course. What really mattered was what to do with Randy Tellman. Finding Larry's real father had put Randy in a once singular category. Larry now hated two people's guts more than he could have thought possible just before this travesty. Randy had to be diverted. There had to be a suitable exile for him in the fringes of Mediate's vast realm, some warp zone of its cyberspace where he could rile up virtual hornet's nests to his heart's content. He had a rare talent for it, to be sure. Larry would figure out something after he calmed down, got some productive energy back, and could think straight. For now, Fran's continuing reports on Angela and the crash aftermath would show the world the power of the bigger story. None of this half-baked, back-ass jitterbug stuff that assaulted the senses and served no public good. Fran knocked on Deanne's bedroom door. No reply. She knocked again, then opened it a crack, met by the tinny sound of music playing too loudly into Deanne's earbuds. She sprawled on her bed, tummy down, reading a graphic novel. She wore a baggy shirt and pants, her feet bare. Her room remained fluffy and pink, top to bottom. "Deanne?" Fran said. "Hi, Mom." Deanne didn't move. "May I come in?" Deanne shrugged. Fran walked where she could see Deanne's profile, then crouched down to face her. Deanne pretended to continue reading, making a show of turning a page. Fran waited. Finally, Deanne turned to say, "I've had my butt chewed out, like totally. There's nothing left for you." Fran laughed heartily. "God, you're funny." Then silently mouthed over the wall of sound in Deanne's ears, "I love you." Deanne struggled to contain a laugh, but couldn't. "The Fran Estates is holding a room for you. Major redecorating required. Full mum and service, all the lousy cooking you could ever want. Are you really home for a while? Try me." At 9 the next morning, Fran headed toward Larry's office, without makeup and comfortable in jeans, definitely not her city working clothes. From open doors along the hallway, colleagues of every sort and level shouted out, "Hey, Fran, way to go. Hot stuff. Award time, baby. You're looking good." She waved and said thanks, not slowing a beat. Nora watched, eyes wide to Fran's approach. "You're back so soon. I'll buzz Mr. Singer." "Anyone else in there?" Nora shook her head. Fran said, "Good, I'll surprise him." Nora crooked her index finger for Fran to lean close and whispered, "He's a little tired, a little worse for wear." Fran said in a normal voice, "Yeah, the world's a mess and all this shakedown, shake-up crap here. Poor guy, I'm beat, too." Nora anxiously watched Fran tap on Larry's door, then step into his office. Larry's drooping head bounced up in shock. "Fran, what the hell are you doing here?" "Checking in, checking out. Got a minute?" "You're not due back for a week. I mean, I'm glad to see you, but mind if I sit?" "Please, mind if I stand, run around, scream?" Fran laughed and took a chair. "Yeah, kind of sudden, but something happened." "What?" "Angela. Oh, man, talk about payoffs. Check the edges and miracles happen. The whole world's keen for the follow-up." "No," Fran said quickly. "She's flying back to the States, moving in with relatives, starting life over. A pox on any jerk who sticks a mic in her face. I think I said that in my report." "More or less. But doesn't matter how politely or straight on you said it, it's not going to happen. She's got paparazzi and news stalkers." "Not for long. She'll disappear into suburbia and the news moves on." "Yeah, but we're doing the whole big picture, everything that happened before it happened, right? You getting that?" "Not me." "I can see that, unless you're chasing some sizzling lead here." She shook her head. "No, I'm done. I'm home for my kid." Larry blinked. "So it's not Angela, it's the Anne." "Both." "What happened with the Anne? Is she okay?" "Yeah, between spells of hell's a poppin'. A little AWOL, a little pot, a lot of sass. Our nanny took off and got married last year, right? Left the poor kid to unmitigated, unmediated Cindy every day. I'd be running and toking too, but don't tell her that." "So, get a new nanny. Ask me for a raise to cover it." "No, a no. Juanita, well, she knew the Anne from a baby, and Cindy had to put up with her because she came with the package. But a new nanny? I wouldn't wish either Cindy or the Anne on anyone." "So what's happening with the crash story?" Fran shrugged. "Nothing. We got the scoop, the sky-high ratings. Her aunt's going to keep it exclusive to us, I'm pretty sure. Nothing in writing, but she agrees, for Angela's sake, to limit media access to us to protect her. I suggested a 6-month or 1-year update." Larry held up his hands. "Okay, okay, you're dropping the hottest story around, and I don't mean Angela, but all the peripherals. I can't believe it." His voice grew tight, volume rising. "I mean, I give you a new directive, and everything starts cooking. Then, with no warning, just like that, you..." He snapped his fingers and sputtered for words. Fran winced, steeling herself for the dressing down. Larry stopped himself and let out a noisy breath. "Oh, hell, forget it. I'll deal with it." He closed his eyes briefly to calm himself, then drilled them back on Fran, saying, "The problem, right here, right now, is you. What are we going to do with you?" "Yelling and screaming might be a good idea. We'd both feel better." Larry laughed. "No, I've got other abuses in mind." "Well, I don't, but I'll think of something." "What do you mean by I'm done? As in you want something closer to home, to the Anne, maybe back in the district?" Fran shook her head. Not a chance. "How about, oh, I don't know, a producer's job in the tower? Oh, God, no, I go nuts when I'm caged, and the bureaucracy would kill me." "So listen, this is a long shot, shooting from the hip, but how'd you like to share this chair with me, do all the fun parts while I kill Randy?" Fran laughed. "That would be the fun part." "So we do it together. Come on, half time each, you pick your hours, I'll take the rest. It'll be exciting, the two of us working like mad squirrels on the peripherals, and help you achieve your life's goal so quickly, forget it." Larry sat back. "Okay, for now. What is your life's goal, work-wise? Describe the perfect job." Fran sighed. "I've been doing it. I've done it. I know when to cut out, Lair. That's my strength, and this is it. Holding Angela, coming home for the Anne, a whole lot's over and done with, and I haven't a clue what's next. Right now, I just want to, oh, I don't know, slice tomatoes at Joe's Deli. No tomatoes to take home, to slice for tomorrow. No tomatoes to describe as they fall from the sky, blow up in my face, keep me awake at night. No tomatoes in my shop, I'm sorry." "Damn, I can't lose you, Fran. The best I can do is buy you a little time while you..." "I don't want a little time. I want a lot, like the rest of my life." "Hey, newsflash, Fran. This whole life thing arrives one day at a time. That's all any of us get, so let's start there." "I think I've got something." Larry found a manila envelope from May under fresh drifts of memos, newspapers, and briefs. He handed it to Fran. Just arrived. I skimmed it. That's all. You figure it out. Stretch it to a month. I don't care how skimpy your report is or if you come up with anything at all. I'll give you a month at home. At home, not at the office, and full pay. Fran looked inside the flap of the envelope. You serious? Desperate's the word. Fran took a deep breath. I don't know. I mean, I could look at it to make up my 2 weeks' notice. Got to fill in those days somehow. But it could be more of the same, and I really don't. Please, Fran, it's only more of whatever you make of it. Well, as a transition, I guess, but don't think you're getting the old me back with this. Larry laughed. Which would involve changing your mind, right? Has that ever been possible? Fran shook her head and smiled. I don't know what you just finessed on me, but I'll do it. I'm still your slave. Heir to the throne, sweetheart, and don't let hidden agendas frighten you. The phone rang. Larry said, call me if you want, when you want. Anytime, darling. He picked up the receiver and hit the Nora button. Fran got up to go. At the door, she waved goodbye with May's envelope, then breezed by Nora with a smaller wave of her next 2 weeks of work. Nora said quietly into the phone to Larry, Dr. Simons, line 3. Thanks. Larry pushed another button and said, Dr. Simons, hello. Simons said, I've got a cancellation for you. We can start full treatment on Tuesday, 8 a.m. Scans in the morning, radiation and chemotherapy right after. You know the odds. I do, but I just can't reconcile it. First you smash my immune system to hell, then, without the very thing that's going to save me, somehow I get better. It didn't do my mother any good. Things have changed. We stimulate bone marrow production now, along with, yeah, I know, but it's still marginal. The odds are good with treatment. And the glass is half full, too. I know the stats, right down to the decimal points and the graphs of them, for the last decades. Besides, this thing's been stewing for years, right? I don't see the wild rush. When I've got work things to tie up, string up, if I... Next opening for sure is in 6 weeks, unless you want to jump the queue for a hefty fee, or do the emergency route if you take a sudden turn for the worst. Larry thought for long seconds, his mouth dry, his jaw clenching and unclenching. Simons pressed. Well, Tuesday at 8? Light sweat sheened Larry's brow. Let it go. Pencil me in for the next opening. Thanks for your trouble. Bye. He hung up the phone and looked out his window at the harbor etched sharp and bright under a cloudless sky. On the street below, he watched minuscule pedestrians by the dozens, but could see no white-haired Maya among them. He fought tears, saying under his breath, Where are you, damn it, when I need you? Larry rapped May's brass-knuckled door knocker, gleaming in a wan winter sun. Byron barked, and the sound of rubber-booted feet shuffled within. Larry, she said happily, opening the door to him. She smiled broadly, her teeth in place, her black wig almost on straight. Look at you, he said appreciatively. You're picture perfect, as always. She sported a green and orange tartan kilt and bright orange scarf that sagged around her scrawny neck and shoulders, weighted by a Cairngorm quartz brooch. She'd painted her nails orange and smudged matching lipstick over collapsed lips. As Larry wrapped his arms around May, the little lord by their feet pawed at his thighs. She pulled back with a shy blush and dancing eyes. Oh, you're a fertilizer salesman, worse than your grandpa. Come in and find a spot. I've got tea ready. She and Byron went to the kitchen. Larry squeezed onto the sofa between May's stacks of newspapers, the latest on top. When she reappeared, carrying rattling teacups of Olympus tea, she said to Larry, Will you move those papers, dear? I'm going to sit beside you, will you? It's nicer that way. Larry stacked the newspapers as high as he dare to make room for May, and they sat close together with Byron curled at her feet. Larry smelled the tea and instantly brightened. Maya's herbs, am I right? He brightened more. Is she here? May shook her head somberly and sighed. Oh, Larry. What? His voice dropped. Not good. May took her time. You heard that dissidents were released unharmed? Larry nodded. May took several small breaths, struggling to continue. Outside the polling station in Jeddah, a zealot slashed Maya. May ran her forefinger down her face and neck. She lost a lot of blood. Then they shipped her to prison to be flogged. 12 lashes. She slipped out of the country and headed to Delphi, where she died 4 days ago. Oh, Lord, why didn't you tell me? I am telling you, Larry. It's terrible news, too terrible to tell you by telephone. I meant earlier when she was in trouble, I'd have sent a reporter, help, whatever it took. No, publicity would have made things worse. Impossible, really, because she'd never have escaped. She wasn't a story when you saw her, and she isn't one now. What do you mean? It's the type of story. Tragedy. I mean, I could have... No, you couldn't have anything. She used the protest as a pretext to see you, and she knew you'd say no. She was counting on it, in fact. The important thing is to remember what she talked about. Peripheral details, what's missing, getting the story that's missed, although it's been right under your nose for a long, long time. In world terms, millennia, actually, and if it surfaces, it gets killed. We can't risk that now. But the story, in this case, is her protest, her arrest and suffering, her death. It's got to be reported. I got to find out what happened. It's not a story at all, because she did actions like that all of her life. None of it picked up by the press, and you're missing the point entirely. If you want to find out what happened, you have to start looking around you. Exactly. We did that with the Philippines crash and found Angela. It's a miracle. I'm taking Maya's every word to heart. Good. So look around you, dear. Literally, look around you. He knit his brow, confused for a moment. Here? Yes. What do you see? Research. Years and tons of research. On what? Goddesses, myths, legends. To what end? The omnibus view, all of them, every goddess, everywhere, a massive undertaking. That's the length and breadth of it, but not the reality, the story, as you call it. Maya's in here, in every file. Larry looked around anew, as May continued. She's also in the one I started for you of coincidences. That's why I sent it to you. Thoroughly puzzled, Larry said, I skimmed through and didn't see any mention of her. Not directly, but she's in there and here. You see, you're going to be in charge of all this one day, and it's time I clued you into it. I can't just tell you, though, and have you understand. I've got to introduce you properly, and that will take time. Meeting Maya was the first step, and a successful one, I think. Have you made any sense of the file? Does it interest you? The truth is, I just glanced at it through and, well, I hope you don't mind, but I passed it on. May narrowed her eyes with concern. To the reporter who found Angela, Fran Roma. She showed up in my office out of the blue, back from Manila a lot sooner than I'd expected, and giving it to her solved a big problem. I couldn't believe it. She was quitting on me, so I gave her a month to work on your file, at home, a sort of private assignment to keep her on. Quitting on you? Why? I'm still not sure. She said that finding Angela shifted something fundamental, didn't know what yet, but work was getting in the way. May smiled. Of course. She's perfect then. A month is a good start. Keep me apprised, won't you? And no reports, please, on Maya's death or survival's coincident with it, without letting me know beforehand. I must be very strict about that. It could be dangerous. In what way? In ways I hope we never find out. May wasn't about to elaborate. No problem. It's pretty oddball, you've got to admit. I mean, first, it's probably unlikely that she'll come up with anything to say from your file. Then, well, how to report it? It's not exactly mainstream news. Did you tell Miss Roma about me? No, should I? Only if she asks. When she asks. For now, let her root around and figure out a bit on her own. We'll meet soon when it's time. May finished her tea. Byron turned and flopped the other way at her feet. Now enough of this. You look tired. Your color's still off. What's the problem? Larry sighed. Work, May. Work brought me Solomon today. I saw the old coot. May's eyebrows shot up. Larry continued. Not live. On my computer, from video made by the idiot who's turning my office upside down. He dug up Saul a few days ago. Don't ask why. Oh, my. May's voice dropped. How is Saul? Terrible. But alive and lucid and still telling lies. He's a bum, a bottle-collecting bum in New York City, and he'll probably live to be 100. I should be so lucky. Shh, of course you will. Don't talk like that. You're a singer. That wretch broke your grandmother's heart, and he lives to be old. Poor Abel picked up the pieces, only to have your mother shut out his mum, your grandmother, for reasons you know too well. Then Abel, your dad, died, just as he seemed to be mending the rift. Where's the justice? Well, Dad missed 15 years for mending if he wanted it. He didn't have to take on Mum's vendetta as his own. These things take time. Your poor Mum. It took her 25 years to start turning up at a few singer gatherings. Yeah, funerals. Happy to mourn one less of my birth dad's line. or maybe stacking the seats at her own send-off, I don't know. Where were our wise elders when we need them, excepting you, dear May? You're the gem of the lot, and I'm sorry to be so late discovering it. Don't beat yourself up, May said. It never does any good. He heaved a sigh. God, this is dreary and way too late to matter. It amazes me that, after all these years, I can still be shocked by seeing shots of an old reprobate who is, ostensibly, nothing to me. Why should it amaze you? You're alive. You care. If you weren't shocked, then I'd worry. The past isn't that far gone, dear, and it's full of surprises, full of things we knew but never looked in the face. Look at you. Look around you, like I said. That's particularly true here. And I don't mean to get off the topic of your concerns, but to provide some perspective. Larry said, Well, I mean to get off the topic, even though I brought it up. Perspective is everything, thank you. Enough of me. How are you? Are you managing okay without Nikos? Can I... No, you needn't do a thing. The girl across the street is a saint, and the teenagers next door have been helpful, although the police had to rout out some troublemakers, I'm told, just before the parents got home from a holiday. I didn't hear a thing. Parents and kids brought me a big basket of fruit yesterday. I'll give you some to take home. I can't eat half of it. You sure? That would be nice. May's eyes softened as they drifted to long ago. The basket reminds me of the time Aunt Devora, Sammy's mum, your great-grandmother, caught us warring in the orchard, ripe with apples, pitching them at each other when we were supposed to. Well, no, that's not quite the beginning. It was the basket's fault, you see. Oh, it's a silly tale. So, tell silly old me, Larry urged. I'd love to hear. He soon relaxed into another of May's many stories from a vanished world. Fran lived in a refurbished row house on a semi-commercial street. The brick had been cleaned, balconies shored up, and trim painted clever color wheel hues. Ambitious owners filled lower pots and boxes with cheery spring blossoms. Others, like Fran, planted plastic geraniums that had faded and grown dusty from season to season. Shops, dry cleaners, and a corner gas station kept the street hopping. May's old house, just blocks away, dated from the same era. Ralph and Cindy's designer home, one neighborhood over, came from recent infilling of post-World War II sprawl. Fran's home office overlooked the street from the second floor, a converted bedroom from the era of wainscoting and dormer windows. The walls held a hodgepodge of photographs that she'd taken of household doorways around the world, from rough houses to yurts, tree houses to igloos. A paper tornado had hit the room, with her laptop, printer, and scanner sitting in the eye of the storm. A crude lily pad ashtray, pottery by little Deanne, overflowed with butts. A black-rimmed wall clock hanging on a closet door semaphored a few minutes to noon on a gray winter day. Fran slept into the room, dressed in old sweats, her hair disheveled, and sat to watch a video Larry had emailed to her. She lit a cigarette, then sat back in a swivel chair to watch. This is written in the film script manner. The 6 p.m. news begins with an exploding Canadian Broadcasting Corporation logo and signature music. An anchorman sits in a large studio behind a large desk. Zoom in to his face and shoulders. Anchorman, good evening. Welcome to the National this February 12th. The dollar slips, then rebounds. Middle East tensions continue, and yesterday's savage storm off the Atlantic coast appears to have claimed the lives of five fishermen. We go first to Peggy's Cove in Nova Scotia. Cut to a black and fierce night. The Peggy's Cove iconic lighthouse beam sweeps through wet, wild winds and huge waves battering the rocky shore. Anchorman, voice over. This was Peggy's Cove at the peak of the storm about 7 p.m. last night. Radio contact with the Black Swan, an 18-meter trawler from this small but famous fishing village, was lost soon after the storm hit, and the last received message is grim. Fisherman, voiceover, crackling transmission. Geez, boy, she's a whirlwind 1,000 feet across, sucking us down like the devil she is. Anchorman, voiceover, transmission ended there with no further contact. Night and the storm's ferocity delayed the Coast Guard search until dawn this morning. No traces of the vessel have been found. Reporter Cole Preston visited Peggy's Cove earlier today. Cut to Cole Preston, a dark-skinned man in a yellow sou'wester hat and rain slick, standing on the road winding through Peggy's Cove. His features are scarcely visible through the rain-smattered camera lens as he points out ghosts of houses scattered over the small rocky bay. He fights the wind, which tears his voice away. Cut to Preston standing warm and dry inside a quaint kitchen. He's a well-dressed city fellow in the crowd of homespun local citizens. He looks young but speaks authoritatively. Preston, Peggy's Cove is home to 20 or so families in snug homes such as this. The tourist trade drives this village, although some still fish for their livings. Generations here know well the fury of the sea and the price it exacts. No family has been spared. Today, five families wait in hope and dread for news about their fathers, grandfathers, brothers, uncles, and cousins. Putting the mic to an old man. You've sailed in hundreds of storms. Did you ever see a whirlpool? Old man. No, sir, I didn't. There's tales aplenty, but them that sees them only sees them once. Preston, so you're saying you don't hold much hope? Old man. My boy's out there. God is, too. I wouldn't presume to outguess him. Cut to. Outside of the Environment Canada Meteorological Building, in unrelenting rain, Cole Preston stands under a large umbrella wearing a buttoned-up, belted trench coat. Preston. Experts are divided about the likelihood of a giant whirlpool sucking a boat into it, although they don't rule it out. Cut to. Preston inside the building holding a mic to a weatherman who points to the satellite image of the storm on the computer monitor. Weatherman, they were at the eye right here. The physics of giant whirlpools at sea are unclear, although fishermen's tales abound with stories of being sucked into the abyss. If it's true, and I wouldn't dismiss it, the vessel would be drawn into it and immediately destroyed. Preston, any hope for survivors? Weatherman, well, at this point, the whirlpool is one fisherman's report, his interpretation of a very black night. Let's hope he mistook a deep trough associated with a rogue wave for something worse. Preston, seas are too rough yet for the Coast Guard to search the waters where the black swan lost radio contact. What's the forecast for tomorrow? Weatherman, much the same, I'm afraid. Cut to the 6 p.m. news with signature CBC logo and music, Saturday, February 13th. Zoom in to the anchorman at his desk. Anchorman, stormy seas off Nova Scotia still hamper the search for the five fishermen whose boat disappeared yesterday. Cut to Cole Preston outside the Sou'wester restaurant in Peggy's Cove, where the weather is clear enough for him to report outside. The wind whips at his uncovered head and trench coat. A small group of residents surround him. Matronly woman wiping away tears. Bless our lads, they're in a better place. We'll see them by and by. Younger woman, I'm not giving up. I'm looking for a miracle. And since the Lord's taken so many of our men over the years, I'm expecting one's due. Teenage boy, overdue. Cut to the 6 p.m. news with signature CBC logo and music, February 14th. Zoom in to the anchorman at his desk. Anchorman. The Coast Guard has called off all search vessels and helicopters looking for the five missing fishermen off the coast of Nova Scotia. They are all presumed lost and dead, victims of a vicious storm and possible freak whirlpool on February 11th. The outport is in mourning, with memorial services being planned. Next Monday, following the 10 p.m. news final, we'll carry a documentary report on this disaster in the context of the collapse of the maritime fishery and the hardship of life in this struggling industry. Cut to the 6 p.m. news with signature logo and music, February 15th. Cut to Cole Preston standing on a cold, clear, desolate shore of Nova Scotia. Preston, here. Exactly here is where Jerry McMahon washed up on shore late this afternoon, 110 kilometers from where the black swan went down. He walked 2 frozen kilometers to the nearest home and to safety. His clothing turned to ice in temperatures of minus 10 degrees Celsius, 30 below, with wind chill factored in. He was taken immediately to the regional hospital, where his core temperature registered below that normally considered possible for an adult to survive. Jerry McMahon is a walking miracle. Preston holds up a photograph of Jerry McMahon grinning beside the black swan docked under bright summer skies. Zoom in to McMahon's out-of-focus face. Preston, voice over. McMahon is in acute care at present, with only immediate family allowed to see him. Word is that he's fully aware and basically uninjured and unimpaired. His family has declined interviews at this point. More on this amazing story as it unfolds. Cole Preston, CBC News, Peggy's Cove, Nova Scotia. Fran sat back and drew hard on her cigarette. From tousled head and unbrushed hair, she looked at her watch, which showed international times on an extra outer band. She checked the calendar and muttered, "Down on the 11th, last transmission, a little after," she quickly calculated. 1 a.m. on the 12th Greek time, washed up 2 days later. Ooh, too much for me. She stubbed out her cigarette. She headed downstairs to her small kitchen to get coffee from a thermos carafe. Bits of 100 countries had found their way into her kitchen, the only purchases she allowed herself, other than little gifts for the Anne. Cooking utensils, gadgets, and gewgaws fought for space on shelves, hanging, stuck with magnets, or crammed into corners beside unlikely partners from half a world away. She could cube eggs, curl butter, tap sugar maples, kebab with dozens of ornamented sticks, make sticky rice balls, dry tea bags on a little line, mortar and pestle many different ways, cook strange things from a polyglot of books. The possibilities were mind-boggling, far ahead of her poorly stocked cupboards. From a nearly empty one, she fetched sugar cubes to drop into her big pottery mug. Fast food boxes reigned in the fridge, although a fresh jug of milk kept three oranges company. Home life was improving. She sat on a stool at a sidebar overlooking the sunroom, which doubled as the main and seldom used dining area. It held a glass top, bamboo and wicker table, four chairs, and several large silk plants. "They have to go," she thought, then said, "Hey, fake plants, your real cousins are coming back." She got up to shake thick dust off a few leaves. She smiled and muttered, "Don't you know that this is nature's way of telling you to move around?" Restless, with coffee cup in hand, she threw open the sunroom doors and stepped out. She surveyed her fenced backyard, a long, narrow rectangle of overgrown lawn and garden beds. At the far end, honeysuckle brambles covered a small shed. She wandered through the remains of last year's pathetic attempts at growing beans, basil, and what was it? Lettuce seeds? Some corn kernels from a popcorn bag? A few brave crocuses emerged through mats of rotted leaves. She crouched to pay her respects to these tender volunteers. She caught a faint smell in the air, cocked her nose, and traced it to the dark interior of the shed. Midst the rakes, old pots, and cobwebs, she saw the small red glow of the burning cigarette butt that the Anne and a girlfriend were sharing. Fran shrieked, "What the hell are you doing?" "Is this a trick question?" the Anne asked. Her girlfriend giggled and started choking. "Put it out!" The Anne defiantly took a deep drag on the cigarette. "Now! And why aren't you in school?" Fran's voice rose an octave. The Anne leisurely dropped the cigarette and killed it with a twist of her foot. "Well?" "Well, what?" "School, dear. Today is a school day. You are a school-aged child. Do you get my drift?" "It's half a day. Besides, I'm burned out. I'm taking a month off. And I'm like practicing here so we can spoke together. I mean, we're doing everything together this month, right?" Fran laughed as she ran a hand through ragged locks. "God help me, you got a tongue to die for. Good try, sweetheart. But like they say, new cigar. I quit smoking." The Anne pushed by Fran, leading her friend out of the shed. "Ha, since when?" "Since now. Since you wanted me to quit for years. In fact, from now on, I don't smoke. It's that simple. Just not anything I do." The Anne kicked a clod of dirt as she and her friend walked to the house. Fran followed, yanking up tall, rust-colored weeds on the way. As the Anne disappeared into the sunroom, she shouted back at Fran, "I'll see it when I believe it." Fran faced the revolving door into an expensive downtown high-rise, took a deep breath, and pushed into the building. As she glided by elevator up to the 17th floor, she worked to keep calm and focused. She made her way over plush carpeting to a high-end office suite marked Roma and Schultz Industrial Management Consultants Personnel Division. A young receptionist, enveloped in a cloud of flowery perfume, worked alone behind a long, wide counter, locked into her cell phone. Fran stood belly to the bar without gaining any proof of existence from this assemblage of teenage dance club wear. Fran tapped her fingers to no effect. Several times over, the girl repeated to her phone companion the simplest of directions to what Fran guessed was the underground parking entrance. "Two bimbos, God help me," Fran muttered. Eventually, the young fashionista hung up, looked vacuously pleasant at the apparently just arrived client, and said, "Good morning, Roma and Schultz. I'm here to see Ralph." "Is he expecting you?" she cooed. Fran quoted from an old Monty Python skit, "One never expects the Spanish Inquisition." Pardon? Came back coquettishly. Fran clenched her jaw. Please, tell Mr. Roma that Fran is here. Oh, you must be his ex. Wow, she looked slightly starstruck. Fran's new fan buzzed Ralph. While waiting for him to appear from his office next to the receptionist's barricade, Fran took several long, forbearing breaths. His face belied no surprise, no particular emotion at all. His expensive suit and tie rode up over a substantial tummy. As he escorted Fran back to his office door, his girl Friday watched with the interest of a soap opera buff. She only got the opening scene, however, as Ralph held the door for Fran and bade her enter with a sweet, "Come in, dear," then clicked the door shut behind them. He'd splashed his office walls with great canvases of abstract art and several large pots of orchid plants in bloom, lush compared to his Spartan furnishings. A pair of boxing gloves hung beside his psychology degree. Fran said, "Dear," then cooed, "You must be my ex. Wow. So she's not Einstein. I wish you didn't hold that against people." "Ah, but what you hold against cupcakes like her is just fine. I married the cream of cupcake steer and we're happier than ever. No 7-year itch? Or was that just a one-off with me?" Ralph pointed to the boxing gloves. "Do you want those now, or should we continue bare-knuckle?" "You think those gloves are hilarious, don't you? University boxing champ, BMOC. Come on, the Anne knows they're a divorce gift. Love that Schultz guy. You come on, psychology degree, boxing gloves, they're funny together. Too funny, in front of our princess, you know. We're so civilized, we work everything out like we're dividing up the pastry cart. Oh no, you take the cream puff, I'll take the eclair. But she knows what's going down and she's swinging back. Oh, I get it. You have the Anne for a month. Can't straighten her out in 3 days, so march in to tell Ralph what a mess he's made." "That's not true. God, I hate your martyr routine. It's my fault, too. Maybe mine more than yours, but what does it matter? We're here now, so let's deal with it." "Maybe your fault more than mine? That's not how the song goes. So, here's a new verse." Fran's voice softened. "You've been great with her, and you've done a lot to make my life, such as it is, possible." "Whoa, can we back up a little? I'm the one who screwed up, and around, but I'm the one who needed freedom and jumped at the chance to get it. The divorce was hell, but I had my work, my ambitions, and the great big world to fill the hole. You had Cindy, the Anne had Juanita, and as long as she was well looked after and I saw her between assignments, I thought I was winning." "And you weren't?" "Oh yeah, I want everything I wanted and more." "And?" "And nothing. I'm not here for true confessions. I'm here to talk about solutions." "Such as what? Get another nanny? Cindy and I have discussed this thoroughly, and first off, she's determined to be a full-time mother, and second off, we don't want another woman in the house. Juanita's irreplaceable." "And how? Actually, I was thinking maybe prep school in the fall." "Prep school?" Ralph whistled between his teeth. "Then we're both rid of her. Great plan." "Oh, listen, please. She's run away once now, and there's more to come, believe me. She needs discipline. She needs authority figures she respects. And at this point, that doesn't appear to be you or me or any other adults in her life." "Oh, so let's ship her off, send the problem to someone else. That's the great Fran way. No wonder she treats me the way she does. I mean, your attitude is so bad. Sorry, I should just shut up around you except for yes, dear, no, dear. It's certainly been best for the Anne so far." Fran looked at him darkly for a moment, then shook her head. "No, this isn't working." As she headed for the door, she said, "I haven't mentioned prep school to the Anne yet, and I won't, until we're some kind of together on this, okay? Whatever you say." "Dear," Fran said as she closed the door behind herself. "Dear," Ralph muttered to himself.